Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
It's Football Weekly with a weekend of action so bumper you could stick a pole up its bum and drive it around at Dodgems, tests say. Today, Premier League, drama at the top and at the bottom, drama. A big win for Ancelotti's sheer liquid football from Arsenal. Victory in Portsmouth and at Hull, the vinegar stroke that helped put a smile on Phil Brown's face. Abroad, Real Madrid suffer Seville damages as the rest of the league get their revenge on the Galacticos. There's the latest from Serie A. Napoli go, Senzuna Donadoni. All that plus the Raymond Dominic love song, why punditry is pointless, and what's worse in a football manager, being bald or ginger, or David Platt. All that in today's Football Weekly. OK, then off we go on today's all-action Football Weekly and an all-action lineup as well. James Dart, welcome back, James.
Hi, James. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. John Ashton.
Hi.
Hi, John.
And hello.
And and to you too. And Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Looking ashen-faced after the revelations, the pre-pod revelations from John Ashton about seeing Emily Hughes naked.
Yeah, in entirely innocent circumstances.
Yeah.
I was, as a young boy, waiting outside in a corridor, a dingy corridor outside a changing room, and with my autograph book, and the door to the dressing room swung open, and there he was in all his glory.
Good Lord! And producer Ben, I won't ask the obvious question. I'll just go straight on to producer Ben, who saw Elton Wellesby naked, but he's on the other side of a soundproof box. Thank goodness we can't hear any more about that story. James Dart, you've also seen famous people naked.
Well, not so good. Michael Strahan and the New York Giants,
right?
But we won't get into that story.
Yeah, my best was Gigi Kanye, but then nobody knows who he is.
It would be impressive if producer Ben had seen Elton John naked.
Impressive and worrying, I would say.
I think Elton Wellesby's more impressive, to be honest.
Right. Rarer, I suspect.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
Anyway, that's not what we all gathered here to talk about. You'll be amazed to hear. Chelsea-Liverpool. Should we start with that? They go top, Chelsea. And plenty of good news for Ancelotti in Sunday's game. I cleaned the fish tank in the first half with the sound on. Sadly, I've only got one fish tank at home, so I had to watch the second half. And there were some good performances and some bad ones as well.
It was almost a typical Chelsea Liverpool game, wasn't it? It's the sort of thing we've got used to over the last few seasons when the sides meet. I think it looks like very good news for Mr. Ancelotti, doesn't it? They were that sort of old style ruthless effectiveness times Chelsea. They look very solid. It's worrying signs for Liverpool. They've lost all four games against the. Without wanting to offend fans of Bolton and West Ham, they've lost all four games against the proper big decent teams that they've played this season, and they're not going to win the title if they keep doing that.
Right. Okay. Well, obviously the Xavi Alonso factor has been mentioned again and again and again, and various people are posting in saying, "So what about the guy they bought to replace him, Alberto Aquilani? When's he going to turn up? What's his fitness state? Does anybody know?" No. All right. There you go, Liverpool fans. We have no idea, but we aren't that clear either on how much impact he's going to have when he comes in.
I think if you're looking at him to come in and replace Xabi Alonso, it's a very big ask. I mean, I think people have broken it down in the last sort of 24 hours or so after the game, and how much Liverpool are missing the likes of Alonso in the midfield. And it's the knock-on effect, I think, to Steven Gerrard, obviously. And Chelsea sort of maximised this to the full yesterday. Not only with John Terry taking charge pretty much of Fernando Torres, but Steven Gerrard being sort of squeezed back further and further back away from the danger area where he has been a threat in the past.
Because there's no Alonso putting the ball forward, he has to come back and get it.
Well, you're just finding it. And I think the record now is, I think someone said, is it Gerrard scored one goal in the 30 appearances against Chelsea now or something?
Wow.
Which is a staggering statistic.
Mm. Okay.
James, you've presumably seen more of Aquilani than the likes of me.
Not as much as the doctors and the treatment.
Indeed.
That's the
but
thing.
I'm told by people, other people who've seen a fair bit of him, that he's not even that similar a player to Alonso's.
But I wouldn't have said so. He's not as
offensively minded.
Well, no, he's got a cracking shot from range. Mm. That's the first thing that springs to mind about Aquilani. But I wouldn't have regarded him as the kind of player who has the kind of personality to be able to dictate play in the way that Xavi Alonso could.
Or the range of passing is what I've been told, that he doesn't have that same repertoire of both short and long passes.
Well, I don't want to do him down because he was a very bright prospect when he came through, and he's certainly extremely talented, but he has been inconsistent. He certainly didn't turn things around at Roma, partly because of his injury record, And I think the analogy you made of a, what was it, clinch pitcher? What was the baseball?
Well, it's sort of like, in baseball, it's like having like a reliever or at the end of the, or a closer come out and having to like, having, usually they come into the game with a lead at times, right. But if you come into it with a huge deficit to start with, you can't really see him pulling them back in that respect. And the question is now, how many more defeats Liverpool can afford to have this season? Obviously, people are expecting them to have a few more because there are more teams up there at the top end. Manchester City and Spurs make it a bit more interesting this season, among others. It's going to be tough to see them lose more than three more games, I suspect.
Yeah. And they have other problems as well, as the lack of an Alonso. At centre-back, they've looked weaker this season than they have at any time in recent years. Jamie Carragher and Martin Skrtel don't appear to be a particularly good pairing. Obviously, Daniel Agger is to come back. Which I think will help. I think will also help in terms of replacing Alonso, because he is somebody who can carry the ball forward, and you don't have to have necessarily a player coming back to take the ball off Carragher as the midfielders currently do, and Skrtel. The Greek guy Stoltalidis, I'm not sure that he's the solution to their centre back problems either.
Oh, well, I was just with Akolani. I'm sure I saw him playing for Roma when they played a 4-2-3-1, and he played on the right-hand side of that sort of attacking three, which is not somewhere that you'd expect to see Alonso playing.
I don't think, and Roma fans will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think he had a particular position that he made his own in Roma. He played left of midfield, he played in the middle, he played right, clearly, where you saw him, but... right wing, of course, is somewhere where he feels at home, given that, as Rusty Bin points out, he is probably the only Premier League player with a portrait of Benito Mussolini in his home back in Rome. And he gave a very frank interview about that about a year or two ago, and then hastily gave another less frank one about it the next day, saying he'd been misinterpreted. Anyway, Liverpool out of the top four then. A little note here from producer Ben, who's been busy this week. In 5 years, Liverpool's front line might well be led by David Ngo and Michael Ngu. Is that potentially the best-named striking partnership since Uwe Fuchs and Stefan Kuntze at Arminia Bielefeld in the 90s? Sorry about that one. Quick note on Chelsea, though. It's been very well done to them. We said great news for Ancelotti. Petr Cech, can he find his way back into the starting lineup given Ilario's incredible performance?
Yeah, it's. I guess it shouldn't be such a surprise, really. I can't remember who it was, and I do apologise, on the blog this week, pointing out that he'd been a very decent, reliable goalkeeper in his previous clubs. And so, you know, perhaps it's something to do with his name. I don't know that you sort of expect him to come in with his big clown gloves and drop things everywhere. But, you know, he was more than good enough, wasn't he? And, you'd imagine Cech will come back in, of course. But, you know, to have someone like that in reserve is no bad thing.
Great news. While Kudashini, the previous reserve, looking anything but reliable at the moment. We suppose we'll talk more about them perhaps later on. Meantime, continuing our Big Four-centric roundup, Arsenal, incredible result there at the Emirates. Blackburn scoring twice.
And they could have had more, and so could Arsenal.
Yeah. 6-2, James Dart. Now, Arsenal fans already posting in saying, I bet this doesn't get the kind of euphoric coverage other Big Four clubs get when they have this kind of result. Well, why is that then? Why do people... kind of go, oh.
Well, you can make the same observation about Arsenal that John made about Liverpool. They too have lost to both half-decent teams they've come up against this year. So it's all very well hammering Blackburn in, admittedly, very impressive fashion. But they still have to do it against big teams. A couple of weeks ago, Arsene Wenger was sitting around with a few journalists, including myself, and he was asked, how is this Arsenal team different from last year's one? And he said the big thing is experience, and we're better at handling key moments in big games. And I immediately thought of Abu Dhabi heading the ball into his own goal at Old Trafford and wondered whether that was true.
Well, I mean, at least yesterday, they hit back once Blackburn took the lead at 2-1. They were almost immediately back on level terms and almost immediately ahead in the game. I think that was a sort of a big sort of 6-7 minute period, and that ultimately transformed the game. As did ultimately the penalty that should have been given against Vermaelen for the foul on David Dunn, which could have potentially cost him a red card. It might maybe have been a booking, but ultimately, I mean, Arsenal were imperious in the second half as the game drew on, and 10-4 would have been a much fairer scoreline, I think.
Right? Well, I think they're brilliant when they have the ball. They're one of the best teams in the world when they have the ball. It's when they don't have the ball, how good are they at winning it back? Not as good as Chelsea, I would suggest, for example.
No, and I mean, I think, in fairness, Dan down the years, we've given them a lot of love, that we give them a lot of respect and praise for the way they do play their attacking football. But as yesterday proved again, they were fragile at the back at times, and that's the big question, I think, down the line.
Yeah, having said that, Wenger is often criticised for not spending a lot of money. I'd suggest that Vermaelen and Arshavin are the two best recruits by any club in the world almost in the last year.
Very
early days on Vermaelen, of course, but
Certainly going forward, he's terrific. John and I did a little bit of research. Just want to put this in after all the hard work. This isn't the first time that Arsenal have beaten Blackburn 6-2. December 2006, they also did it then. But far from ushering in a new dawn of Gunner glory, it led to them finishing fourth that year. So let's not go overboard about this victory, James.
No, but this is the third game in succession against Blackburn. They've won by a 4-goal margin, I believe.
Yeah, so, crikey.
4-0 twice last season.
You take my December 2006 and you trump it with the 3-4-goal margins. Look at that. Okay, here we go. Meanwhile, Sunderland held United to a draw at home, as predicted by the world of psychic behaviours, Barry Glendening.
Yeah, I think more teams should attack United at Old Trafford in the way
I think
it helped. I think United are vulnerable. And in fairness, Sunderland are a decent team, and they have superior dynamism in midfield with Sana and Catermull. United's legs in midfield are going. They're a club on the decline, and teams need to exploit that and realise that the dictator no longer has the power that he had in the past.
Now, so there you go. Well, the top position there. Chelsea 2 points ahead of Man United. Tottenham third. We'll talk about them perhaps a bit later. Arsenal up to fourth. Liverpool dropping to fifth. More Premier League later. But after this, a little musical interlude, we'll be hearing from Sid Lowe in Spain.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Next up, and in no way because we just tried Sid and got his answering machine instead, Paul Doyle, can we ask you some questions about Ligue 1 and, the French scene in general? I noticed that Lyon are back on top. Bordeaux lost their first game of the season.
Yeah, their first defeat in 22 matches.
They were without Gourcuff. Was that the reason?
It was a big factor, but not only were they without him, they made 8 changes from the team that had won 3 days previously in the Champions League because Laurent Blanc decided he needed to rotate his squad. So he brought in the likes of David Bellion and the new guys. Well, they're not new guys, but the fringe players didn't perform as well as the first team, which suggests that Bordeaux may not have as strong a squad as Lyon, for example, who, as you said, have got back to the top of the table despite having loads of injuries at the moment.
Oh, right.
And you've seen a lot of youngsters come through from their ever impressive academy. And
I was just kind of booking the next question, if you like. And it was this. Barry Glendening's always a bit down on French teams and claimed on Thursday that French teams Lyon will fold like a deck chair later on in the Champions League. Raphael Honigstein countered saying, no, this is a different Lyon. And he said it with such force and authority that we all kind of went, oh, okay. But is it a different Lyon, Paul? Will it be different for the Lyonnais this time around?
Well, it's hard to know because they haven't been truly tested yet. Certainly, all the players have been saying that the mentality this season has been much different. They're much more aggressive, much more offensive, and much more, as they say in French, realistic, in the sense that they take their chances and they grind out wins, whereas last season they were a little bit crumbly. But it remains to be seen when they come up against the big teams, notably away in the Champions League, for example, because one of the reasons why Lyon have never achieved the popularity in France that, say, the great Marseille or even the PSG teams in the past did, it was because they've never beaten a European giant away from home. This season, they may well do it at Anfield, for example. Mm. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Liverpool have a tough task on their hand to get out of that group now because they've got back-to-back games against Lyon. If Lyon can get players like Lissandro and Bastos back, who've been injured recently. Bastos was on the bench at the weekend, actually, so he should be all right, assuming there's no relapse. There's every chance of them beating Liverpool and beating Bordeaux to the title.
All that's fascinating, Paul. But arguably the top story in France right now is this extraordinary love song for Raymond Domenech.
Yeah. Yes. It's by somebody called Catherine Ringer, who is a former porn queen.
No way.
Yeah, would you believe? And she wrote a song called Je kiffe Raymond, which means I strongly fancy Raymond. And as I say, it's a love song. She just talks about what a nice and attractive man he
Does
is.
She, any particular characteristic of him that really gets her going?
I can't remember because I only heard it this morning for the first time.
All right.
There's one lyric.
I'd let you penetrate my penalty box, all that sort of stuff.
If he attacked my penalty areas, I would be without defenders.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. So she worked in a football analogy. Yes, that's rather nice.
It's worth listening to on YouTube. I wrote it in my best pretentious music journalist style. I wrote down that it was like a combination of This Is Hardcore era pulp meeting Phoenix Knights.
Really? Sorry, not sure what that means.
I know I haven't been properly introduced yet, but since I'm intrigued by this subject, because I know Dominic proposed to his fiance after the Euros exit. What actually has happened with that?
Well, they've both kept tight-lipped about that, although the rumours are that they have since wed in secret.
What did she say about all this?
About the porn queen homage. I don't think she said anything about it. Dominic himself has simply said that he's quite embarrassed and but at the same time slightly flattered.
Right.
There's a quote from Dominic's agent on one of our rival newspaper websites being asked for a comment about it, and he said, "It's a little ray of sunshine."
Oh, isn't that nice?
Just that Dominic doesn't have a particularly pleasing life at the moment. He just needs these rays of sunshine in his otherwise cloudy skies.
Yeah. I'm sure he enjoys all forms of attention. I'm sure he revels in it.
Speaking of little rays of sunshine, Paolo Bandini, you heard, now joins us here in the pod. Paolo, big question. Who's the most famous person you've ever seen naked? Go on. Got nothing?
Worryingly, I could probably reel off a bunch of New York Giants American footballers.
You and there.
Yeah. But that's a whole different story.
You double-teamed, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, listen. Big weekend in Italy. Well, they always are, aren't they? 9 teams within 5 points. That's exciting. And what's the big story? Donadoni at Napoli?
Well, everyone sort of assumes it's going to be. Everyone's sitting tight and waiting to find out if it's going to be. But as of me checking my... having a quick look at the Gazzetta front just before I came up here, still no news that he's actually been sacked. It looks like it's going to happen. Aurelio De Laurentiis sort of has been hinting at it pretty heavily since he came back. Obviously, he got rid of the general director, Pier Paolo Marino, last week. And you know, Donadoni has this awful run of results. And after the game against... there were some great quotes after the game against this weekend against Roma, which they lost 2-1, where he basically said, oh, he's an outstanding guy and I have a lot of respect for Donadoni. And he bizarrely described him as adorable at one point. But
he's an adorable person. He's had a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
And will always be an important figure in my football experience, but this is the end of an era. So no sign there that
he's going to be... But he's still... There's still been no confirmation that he's actually been sacked, and you know, as far as I'm aware, Donadoni is yet to have been told to do one.
Well, it is international week, so plenty of time for that. A lot of talk about Walter Mazzarri of Sampdoria and Roberto Mancini, who apparently would be the dream manager for De Laurentiis.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Mancini is that he's been up the top of the league, and that's what De Laurentiis wants. He wants someone who he knows is going to get his team up into the Champions League places. I mean, whether or not Mancini would actually do that is a different question, because he had a very different situation in Inter, but that's what he perceives in him. He also very much likes about Mancini is that Mancini likes to play 4-4-2, and De Laurentiis, since he's been very active since coming back, because he was in California, because he's always off doing various film bits and pieces over there, and he's come back a couple of weeks ago now, and he's basically been increasingly sticking his nose in everywhere, like in the Siena game, which they won actually last week. He burst in the half time and started delivering the team talk and telling the players what to do, and since then he's been saying, all I want is someone who'll play 4-4-2, and I think Donadoni started off trying to do that and eventually came to the conclusion that the players he had were better off in a 3-5-2, which may be part of why Marino is the man who got the hook, because Marino has generally not listened to what De Laurentiis wanted at any point.
Right. In other news, Milan scraped a draw away to an Atalanta team playing with 10 men for most of the match. Great goal from Ronaldinho, who'd only just come back from his latest party, probably.
Yeah, he came on at half-time. I love the front page of Corriere dello Sport said Totti sacks Donadoni, because obviously Totti scored both goals for Roma against Napoli. And then it said, and Ronaldinho saves Leonardo. And I thought, a one-all draw away to a 10-man Atalanta is going to save your job. Is it? Well, I don't think that's...
It's not going to save his job?
Well, the issue isn't whether or not that result will save his job. That result will not save his job. The issue is whether or not they're planning to sack him anyway. Now... I'm not as certain as everyone else that Milan are actually going to act that quickly on this. I think they might let it sit and let it ride a little bit further. But should he lose his job the way the team are playing, probably they should be looking to bring in someone who has some, you know, better ideas.
Post Zurich, the talk was all about Filippo Galli possibly coming in, joining Tassotti, who's already there on the bench, or Marco Van Basten, or former Milan players from the golden era,
yeah.
Of course. A bit of a various bloggers trying to find a decent pun about this. About whether Leo would have a messy end on the Milan match. Not very good. Star of Heaven, after defeat at Atalanta, has Leonardo eaten his last supper at Milanello?
That's very good.
That's very good. Van der Vaart next, I suppose if Leonardo gets sacked, he might moan at least a bit. Art Deco, Leonardo! But PF10, on an entirely serious note, says, you have to feel sorry for Leonardo. He's inherited the worst Milan side in 20 years. And I think that's a fair point. It's not really Leonardo's fault, although he seems powerless.
No, I think
he change things.
No, he absolutely has inherited a very bad situation. On the other hand, I think Carlo Ancelotti would be doing a better job with what he has at his disposal.
Right,
and that's the issue of the game.
Props to cuddly Carlo, because, you know, there were a lot of question marks over him, and I think he's not the only person who's left. Kaká obviously is a big big loss to the team, but
exactly.
You might feel that Ancelotti would have squeezed a little bit more life out of those withered old lemons currently populating the orchard that is etc. and rest of that metaphor. Right, okay. Sid Lowe in Spain is in a tunnel on a train or something. So we'll have to get to him a bit later on. Thank you so much, Paolo. That's Paolo Mandini, who wishes to stress that he's not 12 years old, whatever some listeners might like to post. Now, this wouldn't be a foreign roundup if we didn't mention the Old Firm game. So that's that then. Meanwhile, in Belgium, I tell you what, FC20 now clear by 2 points in Holland. Green Calcs and Sid Cajones posting about this. How much longer can this outstanding young English manager stay in the wilderness?
Well, he's been linked over the weekend with the Ipswich job.
Has he?
Should Roy Keane fall on his sword or take his sword elsewhere?
Right.
Because Ipswich suffered another defeat at the weekend.
Mm.
Another last-minute, late goal. I was watching the football results come in on Saturday tea time, and they'd already gone to the classified posh man reading them out, and they had to interrupt it halfway through to bring news of Barnsley's winner at Oakwell. So Ipswich now 11 games without a win and 5 points away from safety at the bottom of the Championship.
Wow. Wow. And so is it a matter of when, not if?
Well, it was... The pressure. I think the pressure's certainly getting to
well, he looked like he was going to chin the.
I don't know if you saw, if any listeners saw the interview he gave with the BBC after the game, and the guy from BBC clearly was sort of wanting to come back. Said people will ask me to ask you if you're going to walk away, and Keane looked at him like he wanted to destroy him with the power of his eyes, and said, "I'm not going to answer that question." And then just carried on staring at him, hoping to turn the interviewer into some sort of powder, I suppose. And you just think, well. You can answer that question because it's the question that everyone wants to know, and it's a question that all the Ipswich fans want to know because of his previous record of...
They're probably helping him with the packing, don't they?
At the moment, yeah. But he could have come out and said, you know, don't be stupid, I'm not going anywhere, it's an early project, 11 games in, 2 wins in, we're halfway up the table. But instead he sort of comes across with this sort of macho thing and, you know, it doesn't convince anymore, I'm afraid.
Yeah, indeed not. So you're suggesting that McLaren might be in some...
Well, I'm not suggesting it's one of those sort of tabloid rumours over the weekend.
A bit like that one about David Platt going to Notts County.
It's Notts County, yeah. The former Sampdoria and Nottingham Forest failure, David Platt.
Yeah.
Is the latest. But mind you...
Don't forget the under-21s.
Yeah, of course. But both of these jobs aren't actually vacancies yet, we ought to point out, I suppose.
Right.
But, Ian McParland's still there at Notts County. For how long, we don't know. But yeah, David Platt, Svenis, a good mate of... Like yourself, James, a good mate of Svenis.
Bizarrely, I breakfasted with Sven Göran only this morning.
Did you see him naked?
I haven't seen Sven naked. No. I don't belong to that percentile of the population. but no, he, you know, I'm not sure that would in any way help. But it wasn't that kind of breakfast, if you're misinterpreting my my encounter with him. But yes, there you go. David Platt, Notts County. It doesn't get any less strange because the other one is Steve Staunton. Joining Darlington, there's no team so low that they can't drop still further.
No, you see, that's exactly where Steve Staunton should have begun his managerial career. You know, he's an intelligent guy with lots of experience, and there's every chance he may become a good manager. Appointing the manager of a national team before he'd started anywhere else was a mistake, I think. We all realise.
He's got a serious job on his hands, though, Darlow. In the summer, they were in administration earlier this year. In the summer, they were down to three players after an exodus, and Colin Todd had to bring in a huge number of players. Well, not a huge number, but enough players to put a team out. Colin Todd's now gone. They're out of administration, but they are rock bottom of the Football League with only 2 points on the board.
Crikey.
And rumour has it in Sheffield that Sheffield United's new big screen that has been installed at Bramall Lane is actually on loan from Darlington. That we've actually bought their big screen from what was used to be called the Reynolds Arena and installed it in Bramall Lane. Which I don't know what that says about both clubs, to be honest.
The pub I used to frequent in Dublin many years ago, the owner of the pub is a big Arsenal fan, and he bought the screen that used to be in Highbury when they moved from Highbury to, and installed it in the pub. So he thought, wow, you can watch matches now in the pub on the Highbury screen.
Did it fit
but
in?
It fit in, but it's impossible to look at because the pixels are enormous, because they're not designed to be looked at from people sitting 5 yards away. So I, at first I thought it was the drink that was getting to me, but...
You could just like turn it on its side and use it as a dance floor, couldn't you?
Maybe that's what they've since done. I haven't been there in a
possibly.
While.
All right, it was just a thought. Okay, now Sid Lowe is on a train, a Spanish train, etc., etc., and there is a tunnel, and Lord knows he's on his way back from Seville from what was only the bleeding game of the century in the Liga, and we were hoping to speak to him. But I think right now we're going to have a little musical sting, and then who knows what part three may hold, listeners, eh? Fingers crossed. Part three, a little bit more Premier League stuff, and I've got a little headline here, why punditry is pointless. Wigan beat Chelsea, and Hull got thrashed 6-1 by Liverpool a week ago. So, when the two teams met this weekend, how come Hull won?
Are we recording?
Yeah.
That sorry.
That doesn't bode very well for the
right.
answer.
No, does anyone know? How
yeah,
come
I was at that match.
Of course you were. Sorry. How come Hull won? Paul, you were at that game.
Yeah, they won because Phil Brown went back to bed. Well, they won first of all because Wigan played very poorly. And Hull didn't play that much better. But what they did do, despite my initial fears when I saw the team lineup and Ibrahim Asanko and Kevin Kilbane were deployed in central defence in a bid to shore up a defence that has become the second only in Premier League history to the Derby County defence of 2 years ago in terms of numbers of goals conceded by this stage of the season. But what turned out to be quite a shrewd move was deploying Kamil Zayat just in front of Kilbane and Sonko as a midfield holder, which he does for Guinea, but he hadn't done before for Hull, so far as I know. And he was really good. And the team worked really hard. I mean, it was a really low-quality game, but Hull worked incredibly hard. Wigan had most of the possession but couldn't create many chances. And Hull hit them on one with a header from a corner and one after a Zayat pounced on a defensive mistake. Hull, they're still probably the worst team I've seen this season in the Premier League, and they'll probably go down.
This doesn't mark a new departure for them? Or?
Well... It may do, but certainly what it does, I think, the determination with which the players played, I think, belied any suggestion that Phil Brown had lost the dressing room, which was one of the things going around. They didn't perform like a team who wanted their manager out.
Hmm. Was it not more the case of two other sort of supposed managerial masterstrokes on behalf of him? That one that, suppose I've read that he's taken down the dartboard from the club canteen, is that right? And the second one being, did he save a lady? Phil Brown saved a lady from jumping off the Humber Bridge, apparently. And I don't know how much he's embellished this himself, but this was on a walk for clarification, apparently, that Phil Brown said.
Across the bridge.
Across the Humber Bridge.
Right.
Yeah, we may be reading a bit too much into that. I mean, he said that he just wanted to, the atmosphere become a bit intense around the club, so he just wanted to go for a nice stroll through the city and
across the Humber Bridge,
diffuse some of the tension that had been built up. Apparently, he did come across a lady who, in his words, was contemplating her future, and talked her down. He didn't want to elaborate on that after the game on Saturday. I mean, I can't shed any light on it, to be honest.
Right. Producer Ben wants to know if he sang to her. but there you go. Maybe he can keep Hull up in the same way that he did her. I wanted to ask about the darts, though. Did he offer any rationale as to how that would improve?
Yeah, he did. He said the players had been getting ideas above their station, and he wanted to withdraw some privileges and get back to basics. And this was.
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, get back to just being footballers rather than people who go in and throw darts.
Yeah, that's
I would have thought maybe, you know, that a few of the players were losing their confidence because they kept missing the target.
Maybe.
Well, there you go.
I should also mention that Jimmy Bullard is expected to play for the reserves during the week.
Really?
So if he comes through that unscathed, may make his comeback in their next match, which is against Fulham.
Crikey. How about that, eh? In other lower end of the Premier League news, Portsmouth ended their run of defeats and only went and won. Not only that, but Lovell and Top Trustworthy owner, part owner, Solomon Al-Fayyim, has now revealed the closely guarded secret that he's about to sell, he says, the majority of the holding to a member of one of Saudi Arabia's richest families. Peter Story, meanwhile, saying that about 30% of the 50 million, so that's what, 15, is it? Million, needs to be in place within a fortnight or Portsmouth will face financial meltdown. Is this story just another one of Al-Fayyim's stories, or is it actually going to happen this time? And why, if you're a Saudi billionaire, are you so keen on buying Portsmouth in the first place?
That's the... It is a complete mystery as to why a hugely wealthy Arab businessman would want to get involved with a slightly sort of tumble-down South Coast club who are really struggling to stay up this year.
Well, couldn't you say that about loads of clubs? I mean,
yeah, but if money's no object, wouldn't you just go out and buy something really big and fancy in a major metropolis?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But why do people buy Notts County or
I don't know, but we don't even know who has bought Notts County, so... Yeah. It's all very mysterious. Also, amongst the weekend surprises, Spurs could well have lost against Bolton. They didn't in the end, but some fine football.
Is that a surprise, though?
Well, I don't know. Bolton played quite well, didn't they?
But Spurs have never won at the Reebok.
It's not a surprise. You're right. I'm sorry about that.
But I think sort of Bolton played pretty well, and I think Spurs would be quite happy in a way to have got out of that with a point still. Even though, I mean, they probably could have won the game at times. It's a fixture in the past that they may well have slipped up on.
Well, it did reignite the whole Gary Megson debate, because we were talking about why he's so unpopular and that, and various people posting and saying he's rubbish, etc. Oldest code, Megson is no good. He will find a cloud for every silver lining. But Random Sausage then basically pinpoints the real issue, and it's the fact, says Random Sausage, that he's ginger. And you may scoff. James, you're scoffing it even as we speak. But then various people posting on the fact that there just are no, you know, ginger, successful ginger managers. Yeah, Alex McLeish, where's the respect for him?
Yeah. I agree with that to an extent. I think judgments on managers are often very superficial. I think someone like, not just their appearance, but also their perceived character. I think Avram Grant, everyone was always very down on him because he's dull. Alan Kirbishley, even, had he been more charismatic and a bullying character, I'm sure he'd be back in work already.
PF10 takes things up even a step further and points out that one thing about successful managers is that they all have hair, he suggests, or almost always. Can you name one successful bald manager, he says? It's a psychological thing. Managers with hair command more respect. I have to say, some people mentioning Herbert Chapman, Sir Matt Busby, in Italy, there's a little pack with them. We'll leave Christian Gross out of this for a second. Arrigo Sacchi would be one. And nowadays you've got Ballardini, who's, you know, done reasonably well with various clubs. And, Luciano Spalletti did fantastically. Walter Zenger, he's as bald as they come now. He had a fine head of hair back at Italia 90 when he was minding goal for Italy, you'll recall. But anyway, and Jack Charlton, says producer Ben. Thank you very much for that. All right. Okay, we could start talking about facial hair and what that does to your managerial profile, but hey, perhaps it's best just to move on to a couple of other posts. Ash Grove, on the subject of shirt sponsors, can't find any mention of the ultimate London joke, Spurs being sponsored back in the day by Pony. Now, that just leaves Spain and one of the biggest stories of the week, which Sid Lowe is not on the line to tell us about, because he is on the line on the train tracks, etc., etc., and there's a long tunnel and that. But as you probably read Disaster for Real Madrid. 2-0 they were beaten by Sevilla, and it could have been much worse if Iker Casillas hadn't played a blinder in the Real Madrid goal. They didn't have Cristiano Ronaldo in their lineup, Madrid, because he was injured. They did have Raul, and apparently that was part of the problem, just like Sid had said it would be. And were Sid here, I'd ask him, Sevilla then, could this be their year? And he would probably say, hang on a minute, they were rubbish.
From getting the gist of having read Sid's blog on the Guardian website earlier today, and still up there obviously for the rest of the week and so on, Sevilla were fully deserved their victory, and Sid's and the view from many people was that Sevilla were almost representing the rest of La Liga beyond against the likes of Barcelona and Real Madrid, against the rest as it were, to sort of sticking up for the rest of the division as it were,
and the forgotten teams
almost, but they thoroughly deserved their victory. And whilst at one point it did look like Real Madrid were going to sort of escape with a point, and which they probably didn't deserve, Sevilla popped up and got the winner, and now all of a sudden it looks like, well, we could have, as Sid would say,
High Liga, I think. No problem. So what is the points difference? What's the situation at the top of the table?
He would say the situation. What did he say? The situation at the top of the table is that Barcelona are indeed 3 points clear, and Sevilla are third. Long gone difference behind Real Madrid. I've often wondered if do you remember the 1980s and early 90s children's program Nightmare, where you have a guy with a helmet on his head and he wanders around the rooms and you hear like noises in the background. I often wonder if Sid's playing a giant game of Nightmare in Spain with a team of journalists behind him, and they all wander around and you hear noises, and it's actually, they pretend it's goblins and that sort of stuff.
I don't know. I'm guessing the answer is no, John. It's up there as a possibility. Well, there you go. That's it for this. No, still no Sid on the line. That's it for today's Football Weekly. And many, many thanks to you listeners for joining us, and James Dart, John Ashton and Paul Doyle for being here in the pod. Producer Ben, many, many thanks. And we'll be back on Thursday with Football Weekly Extra, looking forward, and how about this for excitement, to the big, big weekend of qualifiers. And we joke about internationals not being exciting, but boy, are there some biggies this weekend. That's a rhetorical question. I know there's lots of big games. Anyway, tune in then on Thursday to hear all about it. For now though, from all of us here, goodbye.
Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.